This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there. We really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan at bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. So, we've seen over recent weeks, we've seen over recent months the political parties going to Westminster fighting for more money. It's not looking good for Northern Ireland. It's not looking good for actually anywhere in the UK. The messaging coming out from this Labour government in terms of where there is going to be extra money. But let's focus on the reality check now for Northern Ireland. This is an important story this morning because the Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, is telling you living in this country and your politicians, cut your cloth.
There are no easy answers. The executive, like all governments, must live within its means. So we will support the executive as it seeks to transform Northern Ireland's public service. We get that the executive needs to be able to plan for the future. So we will take forward discussions on a long-term fiscal framework. We understand the importance of investment in growth.
It was just yesterday that the DUP were signalling that there's going to be a new way, both internally and externally, of their party working, and bread and butter issues being at the forefront of certainly how they're claiming they will go forward in Northern Ireland. No bigger a bread and butter issue than how do we pay our way here? How do we cut our cloth? What becomes the priority issues, what doesn't, and those choices apply to Sinn Féin, to the Alliance Party, and indeed to every party in Northern Ireland that wants to have a stakeholding here. Meanwhile, the Ulster Unionist Party are saying they don't support the budget. How do they remain in the executive if they don't support the budget from which all the money flows? 030-3080-5555 in terms of your views, what should we do next? Is it about turning to hard choices and hitting those people hard in the pocket in Northern Ireland who can afford to pay more? Is that what this executive has got to do? Or do they cut public services? It comes down to a short number of options now. What public services do they cut? The harder question, or just as hard for them, which public services, which departments, in an environment where it seems there's no more money coming, do they prioritise? Who gets the priority? Jason, first call of the day, joining us this morning. Morning, Jason.
Oh, good morning, Stephen. I was thinking it's a wee bit hypocritical for the Ulster Unionist Party that they sit on the executive, considering they don't agree with the budget, move out. So they said, look, you cannot set the minister funds that you don't agree with. So you don't. And not only that, they should have put more pressure on the Conservative government when the executive went up and running to try and get money off them before the Labour government came in. Everybody knew Labour was going to get in. And Labour has went back and every promise they've made, and they've only been in a couple of months.
Well, of course, they didn't promise to send more money to Northern Ireland, did they? They would say that they haven't got back in any promise. And look, this expectation that we're going to get more money, is that a game of brinkmanship now? Is this a poker game? Or do our politicians need to realise there's no more money coming, so get on with it. Make the big decisions.
Well, that's the thing. They aren't making the decisions. They haven't made any big decisions since they won. And people, we will still be talking this at Christmas and into the new year. I'm saying this here now live in your show. We will still be talking about this in 6 months' time, because nobody will take this decision and say, look, this is what's going to happen. So we've been told now from I see Labour and mainland Britain, and they have not stood by one promise they have made. They've said there are no more money coming here, and they're standing by it. So we're going to have to get on with it. But the Ulster Unionist Party cannot sit in that executive and say, we don't agree with this and that and the other, and expect to make decisions. Concerned, pull out of it and put more pressure on the executive.
Thank you. Morning to you. So we put a call at the top of the show this morning. Let's hear what you think these local politicians should do now, given the signalling from the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. Paul Gosling, financial journalist with us today. Morning, Paul.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Mick Fielty, editor of Sligo Tool. Good morning, Mick.
Good morning, Stephen.
So is this a chess game? Is this who blinks first? Or is there no more money coming to here, Mick?
No, look, it's an important principle of devolution that you put the key decisions as close to the ground as you can possibly get it. And Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales are privileged in that sense, because there's no real equivalent in England. And I'm not talking about an English Parliament. I'm talking about the amount of discretion that English councils have in terms of setting rates, in terms of basically making key decisions close to the ground. And, before everybody gets carried away about, labour and austerity and cuts and all the rest of it, this isn't necessarily about cuts. This is about an executive, for once, probably for the first time in maybe 8-9 years, to sit down and agree in detail exactly how they're going to cut the cloth. Now, the problem we've got, as your previous caller said, is that the political parties that make up the current executive have really been unable to do very much in this regard since the last budget was set, I think about 2016, the last real budget. The one that was put out recently isn't a budget as such. It's a set of principles. It's a set of ambitions about what they want to do. But what Ben, and more importantly, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is going to want to see is, what's your detailed spending plans? Where are the shortfalls? With the possibility that a new Labour government may well look at some of those shortfalls sympathetically. But until the local executive does its work, it will not, it cannot expect any direct help from Westminster. Just putting on the poor mouth, putting out the begging bowl. It didn't work under the Conservative regime, and it's certainly not going to work under this one.
Do you get a sense, Paul, that the political leaders in this country, that they're being clever about this, that they're being judicious about this? Are they sitting down now with the money they have and hammering out for real how they're really going to cut the cloth that's in Northern Ireland?
They may think they're being clever. I don't think they are. Let's start with the key priority for Northern Ireland, which has to be to reform the National Health Service here and to eradicate the very long health waiting list. That isn't even an objective of the programme for government. Yeah, it's in a broad sense it's an objective, but they recognise that they can't do it. Now, that is a complete failing of government within Northern Ireland. The first priority has to be to sort out the National Health Service. That's not just because we've got masses of people that are in ill health, that are having their lives blighted because they're on waiting lists, but it's also because it's a crisis for the economy. We can't get the economy moving unless we can get more people moving and away from health waiting lists. So strategically, that has to be the main priority. And in terms of the economy,
that shouldn't go unchallenged. Because, look, of course, you give money to the health service and the money could could be used, and then the health service would need more and more and more. Why should the health service come before policing? Why should the health service come before education? Why?
Well, firstly, because we have an agreed set of reform proposals that have not been implemented, the Bengoa reforms. And we've got a health service that is simply not working. If you haven't got people able to go out and about, able to go to work, able to live their lives properly, that surely is the number one priority. Yeah, we've also got a crisis within the PSNI. We've also got a crisis in terms of violence against women. We've got a crisis in the water service. We need politicians that are willing to be strategic, and that means to negotiate with each other and to make difficult decisions. And at the moment, all the evidence is, pretty well since the evolution was established, they've had real difficulty in negotiating with each other and agreeing strategic priorities. And I'm sorry, but I do believe the health service is the number one priority here.
Newton Emerson is joining us this morning from the Irish News. Good morning, Hugh Newton.
Good morning, Stephen.
So what would you like to see them doing here? What do they need to do? All of this signalling now from Hilary Benn, cut your cloth, he's essentially said.
Well, I think that the first thing that the executive needs to do is to level with us that about the amount of money that they have. There has been a tendency, and the UUP in particular has gone off the reservation again on the budget, as you've noted earlier this morning, to claim that there's simply not enough money, that Stormont is underfunded, has been the victim of Tory austerity for a decade. None of these things are true. It has all the money it needs. It has all the money it needs by the reckoning of its own independent advisors appointed by the executive under New Decade, New Approach, the Fiscal Council. It has all the money it needs, even by the higher need that the Alliance Party has said might be necessary. 127% of funding over levels in England per head. That's what the Fiscal Council reckons this year's budget amounts to. That's all it needs. And it has the power it requires to increase revenue. And we have a number of giveaways that we don't need to be doing. I think that the first thing that needs to go is the subsidy of university tuition, because not only does that cost Stormont about £100 million a year, but it caps the number of university places here. It stops our universities from growing. And they could take the money they spend on that subsidy and put it into helping into maintenance grants, more maintenance grants for low-income students. It's a middle-class giveaway across people that don't need it.
Well, I was asking Paul Given, the minister, about that the other day, the education minister, and Paul was saying, what do you want? Do you want people to be incentivized to leave Northern Ireland for their education?
Well, that's completely the opposite point. Because Stormont caps the number of undergraduate places, that's why students have to leave. They don't want to leave, and they're forced to because there aren't enough undergraduate places here. And we don't need to abandon people for students from low incomes. You simply take the subsidy you're giving to better off students and target a huge chunk of it onto assistance. There's already assistance programs for lower income students. That's all you need to do. So very easy wins like that are available. And the fact that the executive can't take any of them.
But before we leave that, Newton, is that an easy win? You're loading students with debt at the very start of their working lives.
Yes, it is.
Before they've worked.
It's an easy win. If an executive, an all-party executive, where everyone's almost guaranteed to be in office, can't take a decision that simple, then we are doomed.
Do you get any sense, Newton, that the question I asked at the beginning, that they're sitting down and they are genuinely hammering this out between themselves and prepared to take the tough decisions?
There are signs to be optimistic. The new finance minister from Sinn Féin, Caoimhe Archibald, is, I think, very impressive, and has indicated that she completely understands the circumstances we're in, and I think would be prepared to explore some of those difficult decisions. Even the UUP has made some interesting noises about mutualising NI Water, as has Alliance. The DUP last week in the Assembly flew the kite off bringing private investment into the health service, not privatised medicine, but bringing in private investors. This happens in the Republic. This happens in England. These are options we need to look at.
What happens?
What happens with private investment in the health service?
Yes. Yes.
Well, there are multiple models. You can bring in nonprofits to assist with waiting list initiatives and so on. It's simply to broach these ideas. These ideas are being discussed. All the parties know what they have to do. But I think that it is an extremely bad sign that the UUP has voted against the budget this week. It's not just harmless grandstanding. This is the beginning of a split that will make it very difficult for the other parties to move forward, because they need that collective responsibility and that united front. So there are good and bad signs. It's not all bad, but it's a very mixed picture.
In terms, Paul Gosling, you're a financial journalist, of revenue raising, what are the big hitters that would bring in what we need?
Well, Newton's touched on one of them, and I do agree with him on tuition fees. Clearly, lifting the cap in terms of the most expensive properties not being fully charged on domestic rates, that's another one. Dealing with some of the rates issues for business, etc., is another. You could also, for example, implement a levy on disused property, on empty property, which would encourage property to be brought into use. But I think actually we should focus not just on revenue raising, but actually reform. So partly that is about reforming the way the health services delivered, focusing more on specialist facilities and concentrating centrally. The other thing, though, as Newton has said, is mutualization. Both Northern Ireland Water and the Northern Ireland Housing Executive could be mutualized. That doesn't represent a cut in public sector delivery. And if you mutualize,
what does that mean? Mutualizing these services
means
it's
owned by the customers. It means that it's a not-for-profit organization. So that, for example, with Northern Ireland Water, it becomes owned by its customers. Exactly the same with the Welsh Water Service, Bath Cymru. And that way, you can borrow against your revenue streams, you can borrow against your assets. You don't have to necessarily increase the charges. You just put a separate line on your rates bill so that some of the rates bill proceeds go to government and some of it go directly to Northern Ireland Water. It's a simple adjustment, and it is something that's been blocked by politicians for ideological reasons.
But John Dyche ruled it out.
Exactly. For ideological reasons, because they don't like the idea of it not being formally within the public sector. But actually, it is a not-for-profit organisation. You can control the executive salaries, and actually you then have a means that we can actually get the economy working farther. We can deliver growth by enabling Northern Ireland Water to invest in the facilities, the sewerage and the water supply issues. It desperately needs to. And
at need the same to, time, need address to point, the era, need to point address out, need to point out as well here. Sorry to cut across you there. We need to point out as well that a Sinn Féin minister 2 years ago mutualised our housing associations, and that has been very successful. They're already being able to get large loans from banks and insurance funds. So there's no ideological objection within Sinn Féin. It's just that water charging has become the third rail of Irish politics, north and south. They're terrified to touch it. If you go back to the St Andrews Agreement, Sinn Féin initially agreed to put a separate itemised charge on the rates bills for water. Their policy was, we won't make you pay twice, but they got frightened off doing even that. So they just need to go back to their original policy on this.
If Newton, because I rarely hear a challenge, and maybe because it's illogical to do so, but if Stormont said, there is no more money for health, we feel that they've got to work within what they've got, now we will prioritise money for other departments, where would you put it?
Well,
would your priorities be?
No, you need to remember that health is 50% of Stormont spending. So it's not a case that you can cut elsewhere and make a substantial difference to health. It requires fundamental reform. The finance minister has already put health to the front of the queue for all the money that goes unspent in Stormont every year. That's quite a bit. But if you want to find any more on a substantial level, you need. You really need to fundamentally reform the health service.
But that's my point. If she decided not to put that surplus cash to health, where would you put it first? Where else would you put it first?
Where else does it need to go? I think that we need to invest in infrastructure very, very urgently. We need more roads, transport, water. The water service could do with, I think it's $2.5 billion up front in cash just to catch up, although it can't spend that all at once. Stormont also has the ability to borrow itself. It has a $3 billion overdraft. I think it's only used about half of it. And that was adjusted to be a bit more flexible. You might remember in the under
fresh start, so they could run a redundancy scheme for civil servants. So they've already run up their overdraft for something like that. I think they could look at that again for investing in infrastructure. But if there was, of course, the part of the problem with this is that the public sector's accounting rules mean you can't just switch savings from your day-to-day spending into investment like that. They're treated like they're almost two different kinds of money. That's another rule that they need to look at. Now, the Chancellor in England is talking about, or people are talking to her about, changing those rules so that money can be switched around more easily. We need to look at that here. These kind of technical changes can make a vast difference, and they go under-examined at Stormont.
This all sounds quite sensible, McFeely. Why aren't they doing any of it?
Well, because I'll give you the simple answer. The simple answer is that none of them ever won seats at Stormont for being clever and thinking about public administration. Well, most of them are getting in there because they're signalling that they're on one side of a divide rather than the other side of a divide. And the problem with that comes when you then sit down around the executive table, because every issue that we've talked about, the three of us, the four of us together here, requires one thing: prioritization. Like, where is your priority? What are you going to tackle first? What's going to take the most amount of money? Where is the inflexibility in the system that we can break first to get to building things? And because everything is built around a sectarian kind of geography, what's not put on the table is that fixing the broken model of Northern Ireland Water would allow places in the west, like Strabane and Derry and even the north coast, would suddenly be eligible for a whole new tranche of economic development that would bring jobs to places that haven't seen new jobs for a very long time, certainly within the private sector. But nobody ever frames it like that because we're too busy worrying about who's the first minister and who's going to be the deputy first minister. But it's that kind of heavy lifting that helps political parties figure out what their priorities are, match them up with other political parties, maybe across the political divide, with their priorities, and then come to some kind of consensus or agreement. And that's been almost entirely absent, really, certainly since the restart in 2007.
This is a really important point, that one of the failures of government in Northern Ireland is the inability of ministers and departments to work together. You can't deliver major priorities unless you've got buy-in from more than one department. Let me give you a couple of examples. Northern Ireland Water is an infrastructure responsibility, but impacts negatively on the economy and the Department for the Economy if it's not actually improved. The other thing is that in terms of the health waiting list, the Ulster University Economic Policy Centre has just reported that all the growth in employment has come from migration in recent periods of time. That's because basically our labour market is flat out. Because we've got such a high level of economic inactivity, the main factor, or the largest factor within economic inactivity, is the health waiting list. So unless you get the health service sorted out, you don't get the economy moving. These things have to have cooperation, partnership between departments and ministers, and that is particularly what our system is unable to deliver.
Newton Emerson, lots of these political parties, of course, care about votes ultimately. How popular or unpopular would it be for these political parties to target the rich in Northern Ireland and take more money off them to redistribute it?
Well, we don't have a lot of rich people in Northern Ireland. Certainly not enough to make a difference. If you're talking about lifting that cap on £400,000 rated properties and above, that is projected to raise about £11 million, which is not a not an amount of money to turn your back on. But I think it indicates that we're not drowning in millionaires here. This isn't the southeast of England. What you need to target is the better off half of the population in general. Now, the better off half of our population are living on the pig's back, really, by UK standards. They don't pay. They don't pay water charges. They don't pay a lot of things, and they pay about half the domestic fees if you compare our rates to council tax. So, and of lower cost of living in general with housing and so on. So, those people, I'm among them. we're better off than our counterparts in many parts of Britain, in Wales, the northeast of England, even more prosperous regions. And Labour and the Conservative governments in Britain are both, they're both looking at us thinking, we can't possibly give you any more money when you're doing better off than we are.
Mm. And those who are better off, and obviously we're talking in generalities here, I wonder how many of those middle classes, that's essentially who you're talking about, would be prepared to pay more if they thought it was actually going into improving the crises that we have across different departments here.
Well, look, Stephen, you and I have had this conversation before and many times, and we're immediately followed by callers, I don't know how represented they are, gurning about how they can't possibly pay an extra £5 a week because they work hard enough for their money, as if that's how taxes are assessed. I think that perhaps you need to make a more hard-headed case to the mean middle classes of Northern Ireland. You can pay £10-20 a week extra in your rates. That's all you're talking about here. Really, literally, £10-20 a week extra. Or you can start buying medical insurance. You can start paying higher school fees at your grammar schools. They can charge fees and they're going to start putting them up. You can start paying for private security as the police no longer look after burglaries. That happens in the south of England. And shops in Belfast are already doing it. And when, once you've started, and then, of course, health insurance. Already, private hospitals in Northern Ireland are no longer taking patients who pay upfront in cash. They want insurance. And that means they're getting ready to seriously stick the arm in at American levels. And once you started paying all those fees, or even any of them, you'll really wish that you had coughed up that £20 extra a week, believe me.
Sean wants to speak to you. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
I think Newton's talking a load of rubbish. Simply. He's turning around and saying the better off students should go to university, which effectively means the poorer students shouldn't. So we put a notice up on the door or the gate, no entry if you're not better off. He talks about more private care in the health service. Why doesn't he try and get his granny into a nursing home, a residential home? They have to sell their houses. The man's a total Tory.
Let you reply to that, Newton.
Well, I specifically said that we should take the subsidy, the middle class subsidy for students, and redistribute a large part of it to low income students through the system that exists as we are.
Excuse me.
And I have had to put relatives in our find care, nursing care. For relatives, and know exactly how that system works and how it's collapsing because people are too tight to pay a little bit extra in their taxes, or will protest on the streets if any basic reform of the health service is undertaken. People like this caller are ultimately the problem. They're the problem. They're the people that our politicians are scared of facing up to. They're the people who won't put their hands in their pockets, and that's why our public services are collapsing.
What's your alternative, Sean? Sean, what is your alternative?
Sorry?
What is your alternative?
My alternative is to tax people like you more and pay you less. And the same with Newton. I mean, let's take it, Stephen. You don't need...
That's literally what I'm suggesting we do.
And you see mutilising the water service? The guy said that means it would be owned.
I think we all have reason here to feel a little bit of sympathy with our politicians when we consider the kind of voters they're dealing with. But it's time to face these people down. And stop allowing their attitudes to completely destroy our public services.
Sean, thank you. Laird next morning, Laird. Hello, Laird.
I can tell you. Good morning.
Go ahead, sir.
Hello? Yeah, that was some speech by them boys there. I can tell you them two that was on. But that man, I don't know who they are, but I wish they would stop putting their hand in the working man's pocket and come up with real ideas.
Well, Newton Emerson is literally saying, to be fair to him, he's literally saying take the money off the some others and redistribute it down into the working man.
Yeah, but that was called communism.
So you've got the Secretary of State saying literally just yesterday, cut your cloth. In other words, live within your means. In other words, there's no more substantial money coming in terms of extra money. So what would you do? How do you solve these funding crises that we have in Northern Ireland?
The British GDP, we are only 2% of it. That's our population, 2% of it. Maybe tell London to stop blowing $100 billion. Maybe tell the two governments that's been in, the Labour and Conservative, to stop wasting our money.
Doesn't pay the bills here for the Department of Education, the Department of Health, the different departments here this year and next year. So these are real tough decisions to make that these politicians have got to make. How would you advise them to make them? Well, do they raise revenue from us or do they cut public services?
You know what? There's 1,000 ways to raise revenue, and putting up more tax onto the working class is not it. Okay. But this show's not big enough for me to tell you how to do it.
Okay. 0-30-30-80-55-55. We'll pause there. Let's get the news from the BBC. Fred next. Morning, Fred.
Oh, how are you doing this morning?
Go ahead.
I think we're going to have to start and pay our way. And that's something I've said for quite some time. But those of us who pay water rates twice, who are metered and pay water rates twice, we find that a bit difficult. So everyone should be paying water rates a little. And a simple way of getting this without saying water rates, put a very little amount onto the rates, and as well as National Health, put a small charge on prescription. It doesn't need to be a massive charge, just a small charge, say £1 per prescription. Hello?
Do we know, Paul Gosling, how much that would bring in?
Cleaning
prescription charges.
Well,
Paul Gosling?
One study said you wouldn't actually raise any money from levying charges on prescriptions because the cost of administration would equalise the amount that you generate. So that's not necessarily going to give you very much money coming in.
Well, you see, why is the health service in such debt here? What has caused all this?
Well, the problem about the health service is we've got too many buildings which cost too much to maintain. So that's why you need to centralise services to improve the quality and to assist consultants being specialists in particular specialities.
Sure. You see, the difference we have from the rest of the United Kingdom, we had about 30 years of turmoil, and there's a lot of money spent then in the NHS, and still is, and those bodies were damaged during that conflict, as it's called. Surely the enemy who were doing this, they should be made pay for it. In other words, the Republic of Ireland, who give secular and support to the terrorists and the supporter of terrorists.
Fred, thank you. Good morning to you. 0-30-30-80-55-55. How do we know, Newton, how much of this is a poker game from the British government? How do we know that they wouldn't, if services started collapsing here, come into Northern Ireland? They want stability in Northern Ireland, don't they?
Yes, and there's always at the end of the day the assumption that they'll step in the end. I think that's quite clear with policing, and the Chief Constable clearly knows that after 20, 30 years of effort put into to make policing a success in Northern Ireland, they're not going to let the PSNI collapse for the want of, £100 million. Mm. You have to ask, really, would they allow the health service to completely collapse? I mean, it appears to have almost collapsed anyway, and they haven't stepped in. But there is a law on the books as a legacy of the abortion row, allowing the Secretary of State to just take charge of any part of the health service. I believe that's still sitting on the statute books. So there, if people began really seriously demanding that the government did step in, they wouldn't have too many excuses not to do it, because they've stepped in to implement abortion services, to commission them directly. So would there be a call, for example, if the UUP refused to do its job, from the Secretary of State to come in and implement Bangoa? I wonder about that. That's, I think, a more interesting question. But yes, your caller who referred earlier to us being 2% of the population, he hit the nail on the head there, although I don't agree with his point. But the fact is that we're so small and awkward in UK terms that it's always easiest in the end to just bung us a check. And our politicians have got far too used to that idea.
And McFeely, where do you reckon the Ulster Unionist Party go next? They're in the executive, but they don't agree with the budget the executive is working within. Where do they go from there?
Well, I can't see where they go other than out through the exit door, to be honest. I know there was some conflict inside the party as to whether they should have gone in the first place, because the classic role that both the SDLP and the Ulster Unionists have played for the DUP and Sinn Féin in the past is what they say in the South is that it's of the smaller parties in any coalition, they're just the mudguard to collect all the opprobrium and anger created by the actions, or in the case of the executive, the lack of actions, which are ultimately the responsibility of the two main parties. So, you know, the logical step, if you're out of step already with the budget and you can't sign up to even a draft program for government that has no details in it, like, there is only one other place to go, and that is out through the door. Now, maybe they're trying to spin this out a little bit to see if they can test the resolve of their executive partners, but it seems to me they might just be a lot more comfortable if they weren't inside the tent, but firmly outside, and able to start articulating. And this is one of the problems. Newton mentioned a problem that both he and I have talked about and written about over the years, which is this is the safest government and the most stable government, in theory, in the whole of the United Kingdom, possibly in the whole of Western democracy, and yet it is the most risk-averse. They are absolutely frightened to go from one side of the street to the other, never mind tackle the issue of four acute hospitals in one major city.
Remember what they signed up to in this latest program for government. You talk about them being risk averse. They actually wrote the word brave in into their own program for government. They said financial stability, they said, will require brave decisions and collaborative working, as well as innovation and efficiency in delivery of services. We are committed to working in partnership to make that happen. So what brave decision are they about to make?
I could write that. That could have been me. But, you know, at the end of the day, self-describing what you have to do to the general public and then not doing it there's no point in putting words like that in if they don't come in with actions, with doing words. What is it you're going to do that's so brave? Like, are you going to tackle the fact that we've got four major hospitals in Belfast? That's one of the things Paul is hinting at, that we have this expensive health estate, which is spread out between the Royal, the City, the Mater, and the Ulster. You know, that just simply doesn't pertain on anywhere else on the island, and it certainly doesn't pertain anywhere else in the UK. And it's simply because, you know, when Bengoa was launched by the current First Minister, when she was the Health Minister, back in 2006, you know, it was all talk about, well, if we don't reform this in the next 10 years, it's going to be absorbed so much X proportion of the budget. And yet, look, 8 years' time, what's happened? Nothing.
Here's Linda next. Morning, Linda. Thanks for calling us. Go ahead.
I'm not too sure how much it would generate, but why are the hospitals and doctors and stuff not charging for missed appointments like dentists? You know, if you miss a dentist appointment, it's £30. Mm-hmm. And each time you get an appointment letter, this is going to, please make your appointment because it's going to cost the NHS £250 if you miss this appointment. So why are missed appointments not being charged like the dentist? Surely that would raise money, would it not?
I think what we don't have, and your point touches on it, Linda, I don't think we have messaging which has penetrated through to the general public. You can all correct me if I'm wrong here. Certainly hasn't gone through to me, and I'm supposed to be across this stuff, as to how much each of these things would actually bring in, so that we can see a shopping list of things, so that we can all as a community, as the society in Northern Ireland, start to think about, well, look, that might be tough, but is it worth it? Like, is the messaging got through?
Yeah, because if you had to pay for a missed appointment, you know, same as the dentist, if there was a breakdown, right, okay, if you don't attend this appointment, you'll get charged you'll not be able to see them in the next appointment. The same way a dentist does. How much, as long as that money went back into the NHS, I don't think people would mind.
All right. Linda, thank you. Thomas charges. Next. Thank you, Linda. Morning, Thomas.
Hello, Stephen.
Go ahead.
Now, I would normally be very upset with you, Stephen, because I normally drive for a living and you keep me waiting in an hour. And I hope you'll let me make 4 points. Number one, I'm now unemployed because 7 out of 8 jobs in the Trunk Water Main Programme for Northern Ireland Water Service has been shelved because there's no money in Northern Ireland Water Service and there's no sewers. And it is going to cripple the local building industry, architects, house builders. We're all going to go out of business because Northern Ireland Water Service is blackmailing the government to pay for infrastructure to deal with sewage.
Well,
number two.
I don't think they would use that terminology, but okay.
Okay. Point number two. As you know, I live in Antrim. I've phoned into your radio shows for well over 20 years, Stephen. Do you know that there are 4 hospitals being heated and lit today in Antrim town, a town of 30,000 people? Muckamore Abbey, Hollywell Hospital, Antrim Area Hospital, and Mazarine Hospital. Number three, there's not an MLA will dodge spending £100 million if he thinks or she thinks it'll get him 100 votes at the next election. They're part-time politicians. They take furlough 40-50% of the time over the last 26 years, and when they're in government, 100 votes, they will squander £100 million rather than risk losing 100 votes. Name me one aspect of the last 26 years of devolved government that has been a big success, Stephen.
Well, silence. Look, you could look, you, of course you could. No, there's not silence, for goodness sake. You could look.
You can't answer me.
Well, the stability. Stability in Northern Ireland is the ultimate success.
Stability is not a government that will not make the hard decisions.
In terms of safety on the streets, I'm talking about.
Sure, the police, there's not enough police to give us safety in the streets. I live in Antrim. You look at the summer that we had in Antrim here. Was there a single politician stood in front of that wee lad's house, the handicapped youngster? Was there a single politician that stood in front of that house and says, "This is wrong. Stop this now." Not one politician turned up because I invited every one of them personally to turn up, but there was an election.
Okay. Well, look, clearly this is
a few votes.
Clearly this is a discussion which we need to continue on this programme. And I think one of the things we need to do, and maybe it's just for me and my memory, is to actually lay out in the coming days the potential revenue raising aspects of the different policy decisions that could be made within Stormont, and let's have a discussion from there. Newton, Paul, Mick, thank you very much indeed. 030 30 80 55 55. And look, if the political parties think that the public isn't bought into contemplating this or bought into all of this, with the reaction this morning, there are a lot of people wanting to work out, wanting to have their say as to how we go forward in Northern Ireland. And that discussion very much brought onto the news agenda today, this morning. It's why we're doing it, because your Secretary of State in Northern Ireland, Hilary Benn, has said, cut your cloth. In other words, sit down, make decisions, budget it out with the money you have, rather than coming asking for more. 030 30 80 55 55. 10 to 10, a new public health bill for Northern Ireland has raised concerns over vaccinations. The Department of Health has said the planned bill will replace the 1967 Public Health Act, ensuring Northern Ireland can respond to a wide range of severe threats to public health. But one proposal would see the department make regulations which, quote, require a person to be vaccinated or to receive other prophylactics. The health minister, prophylactics, I can't pronounce it. I'm sure Sam McBride will be able to. He's with us today. Much smarter than me, Belfast Telegraph Northern Ireland editor. Good morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. So Mike Nisbet said he's not in favour of mandatory vaccination, But this is within the proposal, is it? Require a person to be vaccinated.
Yes, so this is a very early stage of a bill which will be coming to the Assembly. So we still don't have the fine detail of this. What it's doing is asking the public, what do you think about the general principles here? And one of those principles, as you say, is this statement that they would require a person to be vaccinated or receive other prophylactic, which means something that is to prevent disease, basically some other treatment which is trying to prevent disease. Now, that has understandably caused massive alarm among people who either are in some way very sceptical about vaccines or outrightly are not in favour of them, or people who actually would be vaccinated but do not think that any government should have the power to force people to be injected or anything else. And I think one of the fundamental things here is that this is so poorly worded that it's not clear to me, and it's not actually even clear, it seems, to the department what it wants to do. So one possibility there, obviously, which is the worst possibility, if you like, and it's what lots of people think this means, is that this is almost some sort of very dystopian sense of a government holding people down, forcibly injecting them, doing that, obviously, against their will. Now, it doesn't literally say that. What it says is require a person. So it doesn't say require everyone in the population. One other possibility is that this is intended for health workers, for instance, which happened in places like New Zealand. I think it was ultimately overturned in the courts there. But that idea has been around, where in certain jobs, there is a clear stipulation. You have to have this or you can't do the job. Now, even that, I think, is a massively problematic thing, A, in terms of people's personal liberties, but also in terms of the current situation we have in our health service. If you had 10, 20, 30, whatever percent of people in the health service who said, actually, we don't want this, you really would be in a crisis much bigger than if you actually kept things as they were. So it's a very poorly thought out document. But other elements of this have been seized upon by people who have no interest in the truth, people who are trying to make money out of wild conspiracy theories. There is stuff in here which sounds very extreme because it's intended for a time of crisis, something which is close to the powers that a government would have during war. Actually, a lot of those powers are on the statute book already. People are ignorant of what the law already says. And in some areas, it seems that this bill is planning to, in some ways, curtail those powers, because the powers which are already law in Northern Ireland for use in time of an emergency, the Stormont departments now think are possibly in contravention of the Human Rights Act. So it's a very complicated piece of public consultation, but this element of it was incredibly stupid and could have been quite dangerous, but has now led to a situation where I think it has jeopardised potentially the entire bill.
Well, Dr. Alan Stout is less concerned, Sam, than you are. He's chair of the PMA, as you know, in Northern Ireland. Why are you happy with this? Quote, Alan, require a person to be vaccinated or to receive other treatment.
Yeah, good morning, Stephen. It's not that I'm less concerned. I think I probably look at it through a slightly different lens. I mean, public health is an enormous area, and it's a very, very important area. In fact, it was said by a former US Surgeon General that healthcare is vital to all of us some of the time, but public health is vital to all of us all of the time. And public health plays a really, really important part in the health of the nation. And actually, as Sam said quite rightly, a lot of this is focused around these real crisis type of events. It's really important. Let's not look at it through the lens of COVID. This is about so much more. And I could give you a very simple example, and this is where it's going to challenge us. So I'm not going to give you any rights or wrongs with it, but pertussis has been high in the press recently. We know we've had some infant deaths, some tragic infant deaths in England. I think there's 9 of those. And we know that vaccination prevents those infant deaths, both in infants themselves, but also in pregnant mums who are about to give birth. Now, the question for the population is 9 infant deaths acceptable? Is 20? Is 50? Is 100? If we were getting one death a week, is that acceptable? At what point would the government realistically step in and say, we can actually prevent these? And this is the challenge. This is the challenge.
Well, it's not a government stepping in and saying, we can prevent these. It's a government stepping in and saying, you must put this vaccination into your body.
But again, that's where you've got to get the balance right, because what you want is a what you want is education, you want health information, you want voluntary uptake. That's your ideal scenario, but we know that you don't always get that.
And
any government, not just our government, has an obligation to protect the health, the wider health of the population. And this is really where this discussion goes. So again, I'm not going to give you a right or wrong. I'm not going to say whether we support or don't support.
Why are you not telling us that?
Because it's impossible.
Why don't you have? Why does the BMA not have a policy on whether it supports or does not?
Because
mandatory vaccination.
Because it's circumstantial. At the moment, we wouldn't accept mandatory and support mandatory vaccination in any vaccination program that exists at the moment. We will certainly promote it. We'll certainly encourage it. But going down the mandatory route is a step above that. But again, you know, another example, for healthcare workers, there has been mandatory vaccination for many years. That's for hepatitis B. So if our work involves blood or bodily fluids, any healthcare worker has to show proof of having immunity to hepatitis B as well. So, Sam mentioned that it's not necessarily a lot of new concepts. They're challenging concepts, but it's looking to prepare us for the worst.
Sammy Morrison with us this morning as well, TV policy officer. Morning to you, Sammy.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Good morning. I guess part of this comes down to whether, you know, do people know who they, you know, literally who they are trusting? Who would this be? Would it be the chief medical officer making the decision? Ultimately, would it be the health minister? And health ministers can change forcing a vaccination into you for the greater good. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, I don't see any case for doing that, Stephen. And I mean, the minister himself has said last week, on Friday, that he is opposed to mandatory vaccination. It's not for me to explain why in paragraph 143 of his own policy document, which he's consulting on and which has his name on it, he is consulting on that very policy. But there is a considerable body...
Hold on a minute. If a minister only put out for public consultation what they wanted to happen, it wouldn't be much of a consultation.
Yeah, absolutely. But if the minister puts his name on the front of the consultation document, signs off on it and says, this is where we're going to take the legislation, and within that legislation, the proposed legislation, it says in paragraph 143 that we are thinking about mandatory vaccinations, then if the minister's opposed to that, it should never have got to that stage. So you had the situation at the end of last week where the minister was saying that the public were misinformed about this. The reality was that the public got exercised about it. Maybe the minister hadn't read his own policy document, but it is the case that as of today, the Minister Nesbitt is consulting on mandatory vaccination, and that's something that has concerned a lot of people. I mean, there's serious civil liberty issues in relation to this. There are safety concerns. And while Sam and Dr. Stout have made a lot of valid points there that these are existing powers, a lot of these come in under the 1967 Public Health Act. There are additional powers, Stephen, that are concerning. For example, it proposes that a teacher could potentially be prosecuted for not handing over the details of pupils who the Public Health Authority demand. And that is very draconian, and it is a step too far. And you're not just duplicating something that has been there since 1967. You've also got a situation where they're removing the requirement for a magistrate to give an order for somebody to be required to have medical treatment. That safety was there in the 1967 Act. The minister is now proposing to remove it. And
look, I'm sure some of you are busy this morning. I know the news is coming up. For those of you that can stay, we'll take another few minutes of this. I think it's important. And if you want to pick up the phone, 03030805555. We're just in the middle of talking. Morning, everyone, by the way. We're just in the middle of talking about this new public health bill for Northern Ireland around vaccinations. The regulations, it's out for consultation. The plant bill would replace the 1967 Public Health Act. There is some controversy around a proposal which would allow the legislation to, quote, require a person to be vaccinated or to receive other treatment. Sam McBride, obviously, some of this harks back in more recent times to COVID and that debate that, that surged throughout our community as to whether people should or needed to take a vaccination, a COVID jab, or not. Could you conceive in any reality Stormont forcing people to take an injection against their will?
No, it's, I mean, even if you take the position that that's a very desirable thing, even if you think that would be a good thing, if that would save lives, if that would help those people, it would be good for them if they don't know their own best interests, et cetera, it's utterly unworkable. I mean, imagine, I went to the Stormont Health Department last week and asked them, had they consulted the police as to whether they would have the manpower to help to force people to be vaccinated. They never came back to say anything. I mean, I think, to be fair to them, this is so poorly worded. I'm not convinced this is what they thought, because it's so absurd. Anybody, frankly, thinking about this for more than a couple of moments would realise that. Dr. Stout was making the very reasonable point that this is about people's lives. We do need to see it in those stark terms. It's not some hypothetical debate about personal freedom. However, when Dr. Stout's asking how many people would it be acceptable to die before government steps in, I mean, if you take that to its extremities, government would stop us binge drinking, it would stop us smoking, it would stop us engaging in really many of the risky activities that people do quite routinely. There has to be a very strong presumption in a free society in favour of our personal freedoms. Now, that's not absolute. There are periods of plague where for hundreds of years, more than 1,000 years, there has been a deep acceptance that personal freedoms come to an end for a period to try to save lives, and that's reasonable. But forcing people to be vaccinated, I think, goes to such an extent that it's completely unworkable. And anybody, I mean, it would never get through Stormont this. I mean, I've got a pretty low opinion sometimes of how Stormont legislates. Even I don't think Stormont would ever possibly pass legislation of this sort.
The DP's Dan Dodds joining us this morning. What do you make of this wording, Dan?
Well, good morning. This is at a very, very early stage. So we have to remember that this is, we haven't seen any legislation yet, and this is at a very early stage. But the interesting thing about this is that public health, as Dr. Stout says, a very wide, important area of keeping us safe and keeping and maintaining the health of our population. But this particular consultation, I think, is, as Sam said, so poorly worded, so difficult to understand, so challenging in the concepts that it has, that even the health minister on Friday night was forced to come out and say that he didn't agree with his own consultation, and that he was extending, the consultation should have ended this Friday, that he was extending it for another couple of weeks to allow more people more time to look at the consultation. Now, yesterday, it is really extraordinary when you think of it, Stephen, that the health minister publishes a consultation and then is forced to come out and say that he doesn't agree with the mandatory vaccination element.
I'm sorry, can I challenge that once again? It'll be the second time I've done so this morning. Is it not to Mike Nesbitt's credit that he is offering within a consultation some ideas that he doesn't personally agree with? Are you saying it's for a minister to hand to the public what they want to happen? Does that sound like a consultation?
I think that the minister should be giving direction and leadership in relation to this. And it is not giving direction and leadership whenever you say something and agree a consultation. This would have to have been agreed by the minister. And you agree the terms and the wording of a consultation that you then say that you disagree with. Now, he may have latterly come to that view because of the controversy around the proposals. And if he has, that is good. But it shouldn't have taken all of this to get to this stage. And that's the point I'm making. Now, the other point, and it's really important.
Well, can I ask what the DUP's position is on this? You think at a time of crisis or a national emergency, in order to protect public health, people should be required, if it saved lives, to be vaccinated?
Well, I don't think that is the appropriate question to ask, Stephen.
But it's the one I'm asking.
No, but just bear with me. First of all, I think that the minister should withdraw this consultation and go back and think again about the wording of it. Because I do think that your other contributor is right, that the wording of this consultation has led to a lot of concern and the imprecise language in this consultation. And the fact that in this consultation, the Public Health Agency would be given extraordinary powers over the lives of people in Northern Ireland. And it is important that we remember that we live in a free democracy where we do have individual rights and liberties, and we would need to make sure that we protect those. Now,
no matter, but rights, Diane, the discussion here is no matter how many people absolute. It would jeopardise.
Those rights and liberties are not absolute. And there are circumstances where government has to take action. But we should not be legislating to allow a public health agency to have very, very wide and broad powers over people in Northern Ireland. Neither should we be legislating in this way. And these proposals aren't particularly clear. And this is why the minister should think again and come back with more precise language set of proposals.
Can we take one of the more recent examples? So during COVID, and people in elderly care homes, for example, would have been very vulnerable. Was it right? Would it be right for there to be a requirement for healthcare workers to be vaccinated before they go in to a care home?
I don't think that that's a workable proposal. And we've got to think of the actual... Well, how many, even the logistics of doing that may well be beyond us as well. But remember, during COVID, some of the measures that were taken meant that some of our elderly in care homes were very lonely, were very isolated, and were very, very vulnerable. Now, we may say that that was in their interests, and, you know, we all have family members, myself included, who really suffered significantly from those issues. So we have to be really careful when we are giving our agencies of government, arm's length bodies of government, very wide-ranging powers. We have to be very careful that those will be exercised appropriately and correctly. Is why it's important. No, it is important that we actually think of the individual liberties of people and why we should not be forcing people into situations that they don't want.
So you're calling for this, Dan, you're calling for this to be withdrawn, and you're calling for more detail around the language.
Yes.
Can I just be clear? Are you against, even if there is more detail, first of all, what more detail would you require? And secondly, no matter how much detail is in it, are you against mandatory vaccination?
Yes, I am against it. I want more detail from the health minister on the specific circumstances, if he's going down this line, in which that might be deployed. And then I will make up my mind whether I will vote for or against it. But I do not think that we should be putting people in that position.
But you've said you'd make your mind up whether you would vote for or against it, but you've said you're against mandatory vaccination.
I am, in principle, against mandatory vaccination, but nothing is absolute. So we have to actually, the minister must tell us the circumstances in which he would like this to be deployed. And we haven't got that in the consultation. And I do think
it sounds like you're saying that in some circumstances you would support mandatory vaccination.
No, I'm not particularly saying that. I'm saying I'd like the minister to tell us the circumstances.
You said nothing's absolute.
Well, nothing is absolute. As you and I know, Stephen, as we get older in life, nothing is absolute and everything becomes a little bit more sort of not so much black and white in our lives. We all know that. But it is an important fundamental principle of society that
we protect
individual liberties and rights.
the Department of Health has said we need legislation that covers infection and contamination from biological, chemical and radiological sources and brings us into line with the rest of the UK. Any draft legislation emerging from the consultation will go through the Northern Ireland Assembly's normal scrutiny processes, including a detailed review by the Health Committee and an Assembly debate followed by votes of the full Assembly. A public consultation is supposed to stimulate public debate. And that's certainly Alan Stout was doing. Dan, I know you need to go, so thanks for coming on this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning to you. You can see, Alan, and you can hear the concerns here from the likes of Diane Dodds. On the one hand, she was saying nothing's absolute, but she's at her core, she's against the state having the power to do this on an individual.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, I mean, I'd reiterate, I would actually agree with virtually everything that she said. I mean, I can't envisage a scenario where I would want there to be mandatory vaccination, but unfortunately, I can envisage a scenario where we would be having that really challenging conversation about whether it was needed, and that would be in an absolute health crisis. But the important bit, just to add to what she was saying, and this is where we need to be careful again in Northern Ireland, is that we could end up in a position where we have different rules to the rest of the UK and the Republic of Ireland, depending on what they do. So we could have this little pocket of population in Northern Ireland that don't have access to some things that the rest of the UK have.
Sammy Morrison, would you want a border down the Irish Sea in terms of this policy?
I think we would be best fitted, Stephen, if we had complete integration with the rest of the United Kingdom. So I think that's the best way to solve that issue. But I mean, I don't hear any debate in the rest of the United Kingdom about mandatory vaccinations. And that is at the core of what the minister is proposing in the legislation that he's consulting about. And I say again, a lot of these powers are already provided for in the 1967 Act. A lot of the sensible things that the department might need to do in a health emergency are already covered in existing legislation. But these proposals from the minister go far too far. I don't think there are any circumstances under which we should be contemplating mandatory vaccination. I dealt with a case just last week in the office. I had occasion to write to the health minister about a family that had approached the office and highlighted concerns about a youngster that they're caring for who they believe has been injured as a result of vaccination. And there are genuine concerns out there. There are genuine examples where vaccination has gone wrong. I don't buy into the conspiracy theories. I don't. I am vaccinated against COVID and I've got vaccinations in other cases. But I don't accept that the state should have the power to dictate to people in any circumstances, whether they work in the health service or not, that they should be vaccinated if they have concerns about that. And furthermore, it's not just about vaccination in this legislation. There are other things in it, Stephen, as I've said as well. There's a proposal in this legislation to criminalise teachers who refuse to cooperate with the public health authority. That too is wrong. And the minister needs to say that. And the minister, needs to withdraw.
Cooperate with them with regards to what?
Pardon?
Cooperate with them with regards to what request?
There's a requirement in the legislation in paragraph 155 to 158 for teachers to provide contact details for pupils to the public health authority if they demand them. Now, one may say, well, there may be circumstances where a school would be required to do that, but requiring the school to do it and criminalising the head teacher or putting in the provision that the head teacher could be criminalised if they refuse to cooperate are two different things. And you need
It depends, Sam McBride, on the circumstances. It could be child protection, for example, couldn't it?
Well, I think this is in if I follow it properly, this is in a situation where they're trying to test people, where they're trying to trace people, where they're trying to stop the spread of a virus. I mean, one possibility here is that this is an attempt to keep schools open, which I think lots of people, whatever their stance at the time, now think would have been preferable if it had been possible to find a way to keep schools open, that there was lots of damage, which was not intended to be done, but was done to children's learning, to kids who have special needs in particular. It was really brutal for those children. And so, yes, maybe this is going too far if it's saying that the head teacher should be held criminally liable for that. But I think that this sort of very difficult, extreme, really really unlikely circumstances for most of us. The only pandemic most of us have ever lived through is that of 2-3 years ago. For our ancestors, this was much more common, unfortunately. So we are very privileged not to have to think about this very often. We hope we never have to actually face this again. But if we do, you have these horrible choices. What do you do? What is the right thing to do? And actually, I think if you had a really Machiavellian government of the sort that some people think we have, that's being run by, you know, some global dictator, or, you know, the sort of wild stuff that is fueling some of the concern, not all of the concern, but some of the concern on this. If you had that sort of government, they wouldn't be doing this now in peacetime, at a point where we can rationally sit down and think about this, take our time, maybe stop the bill completely, maybe come back to it. They would leave this, have it written in a drawer somewhere, ready to go the minute there was fear. And at that point, as we saw during COVID, most people, if they think their lives will be saved and the lives of their parents and their loved ones will be saved, they will accept most things. So actually, it's a good thing we're having this debate now. And if we leave it later on, I think the government would be able to get much more power that some of these people maybe perhaps haven't thought through.
But also, Sam, Stephen, on the school scenario, can I just come in on that as well? Because it's so important that we just don't go down the rabbit hole of COVID, because the school scenario isn't really about COVID. The school scenario happens already. So if we have a school local to myself that has a case, an outbreak, a patient or a pupil has a bacterial meningitis, what actually happens is that all of the close contacts will be contacted and will get prophylactic antibiotics to prevent them, because there is a really significant risk of spread and of death or of permanent disability in that spread of that bacterial meningitis. So that happens already.
Yeah,
so it comes back to what Sam was saying earlier. A lot of this is not new. This is just about basic public health and is about basic protection of our population and prevention of serious illness.
Dr. Stout, do you know of any instances where the head teachers refused to cooperate with that? And there's been an instance where you would have thought there'd be need to be legislative power for to prosecute the head teacher, because I don't.
Oh, no, I don't. I don't.
Yeah, well, you see, that's what's been changed in the legislation. That's what I'm objecting to. I'm not objecting to us combating the spread of contagious diseases. No one would do that, of course. And, of course, a school potentially could be a very dangerous place, potentially, if there were infectious pupils allowed to do that. However, my concern is that you're bringing in legislation which, as Sam has rightly said, there's fear out there, there's conspiracy theories. If you're going to defeat conspiracy theories, don't put in legislation provisions like this. And it goes too far.
Okay, Sammy, thank you. Dr. Ansar, thank you. Sam McBride, just before you go this morning, can I pull you into our top story today? And just to get your view, you watch politics a lot in Northern Ireland, obviously you do over the years. Hilary Benn telling that executive to cut their cloth, essentially there is no more money. Is that a poker game, or is it time the executive got on with cutting the cloth with the money it's got?
Well, I mean, if you look at what Labour has been doing nationally, they have been talking very tough. They've been acting very tough. That probably will relax over time. That probably is that there is a tactical element to that, to be trying to say, look at this mess we've inherited. It's much worse than we thought. And then gradually start to relax things rather than start at the other end. So there will be some element of that. But I do think there's something that goes way beyond Labour and the Tories. It goes, it really goes to the heart of Whitehall, to the heart of the Treasury, where there is a deep distrust of Stormont and how it spends money that is sent from London. There is a sense that was massively accelerated during the RHI scandal. That was followed, I know, very closely by people in the Treasury, by other very senior figures in Whitehall, including Sue Gray, who ultimately came to Belfast and ran Stormont's finance department for several years. So she is now at the right hand of the Prime Minister. She understands this from both ends of the spectrum. And it is absurd for Stormont to say that they need more money desperately for things like health, for road repairs, for schools, for genuine pressing needs, not for frivolous stuff, for genuine things that people require, in some cases, to save their lives. And that's true. And yet, on the other hand, say, we will not raise more money from people in Northern Ireland, when you have the First Minister, the Deputy First Minister, other Stormont ministers talking in terms of everybody in Northern Ireland almost being on the breadline. They couldn't pay a penny more. It's just nonsense. Look at the cars on the road. Look at the fancy hotels.
So why don't they want to do it?
because it's not popular. This is a populist system of government. The two main parties.
Is it really unpopular to take money off the rich? I think quite a few voters would like that.
Well, it's not popular with people. I mean, it would be more the middle classes, I suppose, in terms of the absolute numbers of people. The rich exist in Northern Ireland at the high end, but if they were reaching into people on the Malone Road, on the Ormer Road, people who would be able to pay but don't want to pay, that would not be popular. Some of those people, actually, if you explained it to them, I think would absolutely go along with this. There is polling that shows that if you can convince people that this money is going to be well spent in something like the health service, they will accept it. But there isn't even anybody in our government trying to make that argument. We've gone backwards. Emma Littlepenkelly at one point was...
Well, that's not fair, is it? Because the Finance Minister, Keith Archibald, for example, it's out for consultation around raising the cap on rates. She's consulted on it, hasn't she? And she's now contemplating it.
So she's starting, so at this point, many months into government, she's starting to consult on lifting the cap. That's one tiny element of this. So that's not about lifting overall rates revenue. That's about changing who pays the rates revenue. So effectively, at the moment, the people in the poorest homeowners in Northern Ireland subsidise the wealthiest mansions. They subsidise you. They subsidise people like Rory McIlroy when he had a house in Northern Ireland. People in massive houses are subsidised. Now, that's not your fault. That's not his fault. That's the rule of Stormont. They have decided that's the way it should be. That's not about how much money government raises. That's about how the money is distributed in terms of who pays that bill. There is not a serious proposition to bring in water charges, to do anything that might actually help with some of the problems, like Loch Ness, like the health service.
And just a point of order, I dare say Rory McIlroy has a lot more money, Mr. McBride, than I have, and a much bigger house than I have. Well,
I'm not sure whether he still has a house here or not, so I've possibly given a very misleading example there. But I mean, the principle of this is that, yeah. I mean, you know, I think to be fair to you, as your listeners will know, you have probably pushed the debate on this more than anybody else in Northern Ireland, or certainly have been one of the people who has pushed it very vigorously in terms of saying, look, is it right that the wealthy don't pay? Is it right that the people like you, even like me, people who in extremis could afford to go privately and pay for medical treatment, if we really had to do it, we can do that. Somebody in poverty cannot do that. They're dead. It's over. And that's the brutal reality of this. Andrew McCormick, former senior civil servant in Stormont, has said this. You know, it's a scandal that you've got Stormont protecting the middle classes from something which ultimately is punishing people at the bottom of society. The two big parties in Stormont, DUP, Sinn Féin, very proud of their working class roots. That's where they came from. They're not looking after those people right now.
Sam McBride, thank you very much indeed. We've only a couple of minutes left for calls today. We'll come back to you all of this tomorrow. Jared, morning, Jared.
Good morning, Stephen. I know we only have a few minutes, so I'll make the point quickly. I think the key to even your top story in this one is about honesty and transparency. In both of those cases, it's the big issue. It's the big thing that keeps coming over. If you have transparency and honesty, people will get on board and go along with it. In regards to the vaccination stuff, the healthcare workers, we're already short of them. And I would be one of them as well. And if somebody was forcing me to take something without me understanding it and just putting me in it, I would be like, I'm leaving this job. And I think that there's the biggest issue around it. You need to be really careful about how that's approached and what way it's done. And if the warden isn't particularly well done, then we need to be questioning who we're employing to rate it in the first place. They're obviously not competent enough to do it.
Well, the DUP through Dan Dodds this morning are calling for the wording to the bill to be withdrawn, the proposal to be withdrawn and rewritten. David, morning, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
Morning, Stephen.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
No, I was just, funny enough, I was just ringing there just that I was in church on Sunday night and the preacher had mentioned about that mandatory vaccination and I'd never heard of it before. But I've just thought to myself, that would frighten people. You know, like, what are they going to do? Are they going to, if pensioners don't take it, are they going to stop their pensions? Are they going to come around?
Of course not.
You know, it seems frightening. When I heard it on Sunday night, I thought, wow, this is how they're going to implement it. You know, if you don't want to take it, how are they going to force you?
Well, the health minister said he's against it, but this is out for consultation. That's what you're doing this morning. You're talking about it. You're consulting on it, and I dare say they're hearing you loud and clear. Listen, that's it for today. We're out of time this morning. Nolan Live's back this week on BBC One. When I'm out and about, lots of you say, when's the telly show coming back? It's back tomorrow night on BBC One at 10:40, and then, of course, on the iPlayer. We're back on the radio tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. So, look, have a good day today. And we'll see you in the morning at 9. And thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast. Today we're looking at Sudan and the brutal conflict raging there. We hear from some of the millions of civilians brutalized and displaced. It's been dubbed the Forgotten War. But is it more ignored than forgotten by the international community? And if so, why? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.